Welcome to the Gary T. Roller Show. Join Gary as he chats with today's innovators and changemakers of the health and wellness movement. Together, we will discover our healthier selves.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Gary T. Roller Show. I am your host, Gary. Thanks for tuning in. We are sitting down this week with none other than raw culinary extraordinaire, Ben Richards. Ben Richards is the founder and a guru behind Seeds of Life in Ubud, Bali. You would also recognize the name Seeds of Life from being the raw chef certification out of Bali, and which is now internationally renowned. Before we get into the episode, just to let you know, I am back in South Africa. It has been a long journey for Claire and I back home. We had some immigration problems and issues regarding our visa, and apparently we overstayed, but I still do not understand the fine that was slapped on our wrists. But anyway, we got through it and we learned our lessons, and as they say, you pay your school fees. So we're back home. We are hitting the ground running. We have some food workshops on the go. The first one is hitting Cape Town on Saturday. We've got a raw food smoothie bowl alchemy workshop where Claire, Sharon, Roberto is going to show all her tricks and turn you into a culinary wizard in your own kitchen, whether you're making a smoothie bowl for yourself, running for your next race, or making a smoothie bowl for the entire family. Who knows? But powered by superfoods, we are going to get everyone in Cape Town feeling vibrant and living their best lives. Cool. So what do we explore in this podcast? It is a podcast that ebbs and flows, super interesting. One of the most enlightening chats I've ever had with anyone. And Ben really has come from nothing and created everything. We chat about how Ben got into Swedish massage at the age of 17, followed by Reiki, black magic, crystal work, aromatherapy, feather work, and also how he started his journey into ultra endurance sports, mainly in triathlon. And this all started by his neighbor asking him to join him on a run when he was 10, 11 years old. That ended up being a couple kilometers over 10K. So I don't know how many out there have run these distances at such a young age, but Ben obviously found his love to taking the body over the limits in order to get to a Zen state. I know for me, it is of utmost importance to find my happy place in running. We chat briefly about how governments and the odd corporate are trying to control us and make a lot of humans oblivious to their motives of profits and remaining in a strong economy and completely disregarding the health of humans and essentially the future of us as a race. We delve deeper into holographic kinetics, which Ben is a practitioner and specialist in. Holographic kinetics, put simply, there's two worlds here, cause and effect. If through our actions we hang on to our stuff, causes, it will manifest in the form of imbalance, effects. Only your spirit knows the when, how, what, why, and where your creations are. With this system, it essentially assists you to heal yourself. Until you acknowledge you have a problem in previous past lives, and within those lives that you have experienced trauma, you can only heal portions of the imbalances. This system effectively and holistically rebalances and is not limited to the following: emotional trauma and our relationship to it, anger, frustration, panic attacks, and fear-based emotions that arise, belief systems, destructive programs, and self-sabotage, physical traumas and imbalances, or simply just giving you an edge in life that you're looking for. We find out about Ben's inspiration, who was none other than his grandmother that was a chef. Ben pretty much went from his grandmother's kitchen to working in bikey bars and messy Italian pizza joints to opening the most prolific raw food restaurant in Bali. And I will definitely say the world. I've traveled all over, and this restaurant is by far one of the tastiest that I've got to experience. Let's listen carefully how Ashtanga yoga practitioner Ben has created a life of purpose and higher vibrance through raw foods and just being able to ask the right questions and nourish his bodies with the finest of traditional Chinese medicine herbs, spices, and living his best life. Through living his best life, he has motivated and helped transform so many people through his raw chef certification. So join me as I chat to Ben, and don't forget to reach out to him. And if you're in Bali, pop in to Seeds of Life. I hung out there daily when I was in Ubud. Enjoy the show. Peace and love. So we are transmissioning to you from the beautiful Ubud, the main streets where all the top restaurants are, but my favorites, absolute favorite. I've traveled all around the world, and Seeds of Life is one of the most gorgeous, beautifully tasting menus I've ever come across. I've been here for 5 days and I've already been here 3 times. It's beautiful. And I'm sitting here with Ben, the chief innovator, culinary wizard of, let's call it this brand. It's not just a cafe. I want to get into something. On your websites, you introduce us, we combine the elements of fun, flavor, vibrancy, and integrity through raw living foods, yoga, and holographic kinetics, an omnipotent healing modality that exceeds all levels of what a holistic approach to understanding this game of life is all about and what it means to be truly free. That is one massive mouthful.
Yeah.
Ben, how... You haven't just landed up here. It's not an overnight success.
Yeah, it's been a ride.
Thank you once again for having me in your beautiful space.
No worries. Thank you for the interview. Yeah,
of course. Where did your story start?
Like most people, I guess, you know, we've just had a rough entry into the world when I was young, you know, and forced me to question things differently to I guess, I don't know, I've got no comparisons, but you know, I certainly was forced to question things deeply, and was pulled into facing reality, you know, very young, and looking around at the world and seeing a lot of suffering, and yeah, just grew up wanting to do something about it, wanting to free myself from those things, assist my family if they wanted to, you know, free themselves from the suffering. And
did you go through your own form of suffering?
Oh yeah, yeah, it was radical.
Through
radical
through what big industry and society preaches us, or
well, you know, systemically our issues are all there for us to learn through, and I'm grateful for everything that's happened and will continue to happen, no doubt. As we move out of this last phase of the cycle. You know, my mother, she got into drugs at the age of 12, you know, and she was addicted to some really heavy drugs, and she had me when she was 14, addicted to drugs, you know, so I lived the life of a drug addict, of a heroin addict's child, you know, which was, you know, really heavy. But I, you know, when you grow up in something, you don't know any different. It's, yeah, you adapt and
it becomes the norm.
Yeah. It's quite normal. As I kind of got older and started, you know, it was my first real girlfriend that I had, and go around to her house on the weekend and see what a normal kind of life looked like, you know, a mom, a dad, a brother, and like, you know, dogs, breakfast being cooked Saturday morning with the family around, you know. Lots of love in the house, lots of light, regularity, consistency, the same thing. And I was like, wow, okay, so not everyone's life is like that. You know, you go to school and you see kids at school and you've got no idea what goes on behind their doors. So I was just thinking, you know, everyone's got their own stuff to go through. And then I was like, you know, kind of thought, well, you know, where does this suffering come from? And yeah, just when your mother's, you know, on the nod or passed out, you know, in a plate of food and you're 4 years of age and, you know, you kind of called into action, you know, you're going to pull her face out of the hot spaghetti or whatever she's just prepared and, you know, like taking care of people, you know, instead of, you know, so much having fun as a child, you know, was just something that, like, I was called into that reality very young. You know, it's definitely made me who I am today. I didn't grow up feeling like I missed out on anything because I didn't know any different, you know.
Yeah.
And by the time I got to realize that my life was radically different from most people that were in my circle anyway, of friends, yeah, there was no story to be told. There was no need to feel sorry for myself or, you know, there's no need to play a victim. It was just, oh, yeah, so this is how you get on with life and just keep your head up. And I realized a lot of people couldn't keep their head up. They didn't know how to do that, you know. So one thing that really helped me was I was a long-distance runner and triathlete. You know, I was, you know, one of the best in Australia. You know, I used to compete at a very high level. And I guess it was that kind of, you know, it wasn't like I was running away from my issues because I didn't feel I really had any issues. It was just pounding the pavement. Like I'd go and run 20 kilometers, you know, just in an afternoon. And I could just go places when I was on the road, when I was running, no one around, no one to ask me questions or get me to do anything or, you know, clean my room or, you know, there was just me and the road. So it was really nice meditation. I would just go inwards and explore, you know, not just my physiology and my breath, but, you know, the other emotions that come up around running so far. Yeah. And then going, geez, I've got to turn around and go back now. You know, my muscles are sore. I haven't had any water, you know, like just pushing myself through these areas. But I'd find myself in a meditation and I'd be off and I'd go, wow, this has got to be pretty far from home. And I'd ride out there the next day on my bike with a speedometer and realized, you know, the whole thing was, you know, 25 or 30 kilometers. And so I found that was a tool that I could use to just get me to look at stuff that, you know, people, well, for one, I didn't know how to ask the right questions because I was young.
How old were you at this stage when you were...
When I was running?
Delving into, yeah, like ultra distance stuff.
It was primary school, at the end of primary school, where, what's that, grade, like
grade
11.
Grade 8, grade...
Yeah, grade 7, grade 8, that's like 11 or 12, yeah. Right? 11 or 12 years old. So that's kind of, it was 10, my mother died when I was 9. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was about a year after that where I just met this guy who was living next door and he would just he would just run 15 Ks every afternoon. He just grabbed me one day and said, put your shoes on, let's go for a run. And we just ran and I came back and he's like, wow, you just did that really easily. We just ran 15 Ks. And because he was an ultra marathon runner, he would run like 70 or 80 Ks, you know, on races on the weekend and that. And he said, you did that really easily. I was like, he said, you want to go again tomorrow? And I said, yeah, if I'm around. And next day, my body felt good. My muscles were good. And we did it again. And I was like, wow, this is really good. I like this. So, yeah, it kind of started really young. I was about 10 or 11. And then, yeah, I just started without training, just competing at competitions at school. You know, the school cross country, go to the regionals and, you know, the states and then the nationals and that sort of thing. Just... Mm. Pretty much without doing any training. And then I got into training, got a proper structure. Yeah. I ended up with a coach. He trained 3 Olympic champions.
Who was your coach?
His name was Lloyd Way.
Lloyd Way, okay.
And he trained 3 Olympic champions as well for the 1500. He was a middle distance trainer, you know. Yeah. So I found myself amongst those kind of people. And, you know, I got to a point where I just realized that that was a modality of, like, introspection and yeah, just thought if other people could have access to something like that, it might be able to help them. So when I was 17, I started learning massage techniques.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea. I thought, well, what's healing? What is that, you know, and thought it was massage. So, yeah, I started doing Swedish massage. Was my first course when I was 17 and used to do body work on my girlfriend, and she had a sore back and it used to work, and I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. And
best boyfriend in Oz.
Well, you know, it was all for me, really. I was like, I wanted to know more. I wanted to help people, you know, and then little did I know that there was all of this unfolding ahead.
It's super interesting. I followed a similar path, Dharma, with regards to triathlon and ultra distance running. I came out of addiction.
Okay.
So I was on the other end of the spectrum, and then I found triathlon, and I've exactly the same as you. I found the same way of being able to connect mindfully, just being out there on the road and just getting away from the noise.
Yeah.
And, I mean, since then, obviously gone into more like nutrition stuff. So it's a very similar path. But I want to, a lot of people, whether it's growing up in addiction household or whether it's growing up with actual personal addiction, everyone's got their own story or strife, should I say. I always say opportunity because it kind of forces you to leap forward. What was one of the biggest things that you learned personally with having a mom that was addicted to heroin and losing her at 9, I mean, you're at a very vulnerable age. You obviously had to find your feet very quickly. What was one of the biggest learning capabilities you drew from this? Or lessons, should I say?
That society's a mess. And, you know, she was a product of her father's manipulation. And he was a product of society's manipulation, you know. He was, you know, an alcoholic and didn't treat the family good. And he was just under stress from life, you know. Like, we can do better. We've got all the tools, all the technology, all the resources to make, you know, this spaceship planet Earth the most rocking party in the universe, and it's deliberately made the opposite. There is zero doubt in my mind. So my mother's issues are essentially, you know, her creation. You know, she created that reality for herself ultimately, so I've learnt later. But as a result, you know, society isn't structured in a way to help people truly, you know. It's basically an economy, you know, and people who have a dollar value, governments are, you know, they get lobbied by very big businesses with huge dollar values. And then they get, you know, federal law binding these contracts where the governments can't do anything to help the people. So government can't do anything for us because they've taken money because we want, you know, 25 signs on every corner saying turn left and fix this sidewalk and have rubbish bins and all this stuff. You know, it's just, it's systemically, it's a mess.
Mm.
A lot of this stuff that's kind of necessary, but, you know, like, yeah, we do need safety. We do need to be hygienic. We do need a clean environment. We need to take care of everything. But, you know, the governments won't change their policies. One, because those people who are in the power of that and who are in control of us, they're uninitiated human beings. They don't go through any rites of passage. They're not trained in really caring for people. You know, they, most of those people have a lot of money and they come from wealth and they're in power to make more money for the country, you know, because that's what people value is, you know, a country that has a strong economy. Unfortunately, what that means is the majority of humans, not the fortunate few, but the majority of humans are suffering greatly as a result. And then there's no really effective modalities that change people's reality and get them on track. There's a lot of stuff out there. I've studied a lot of things that appear to work or have a good sales pitch, but very few modalities actually change the human's reality or the spirit of that human, the spirit's reality so much that they flip 180 degrees and create the most epic reality of their dreams. It's just not structured like that. That's what I learned. It's not structured like that. If it was structured like that, then it would happen. It would have happened a long time ago, but it's never going to happen the way we are going.
Yeah.
And people are crazy if they think it is. People vote for their governments. They love their governments. They, you know, it's crap. People are brainwashed.
Well, their decision-making has essentially been taken away from them. I always love questioning people when they say, like, I want this. I'm eating this because I want this, or I'm doing this because I want this. And I try and challenge them. I'm like, are you doing this because you want to, or have you been told that you want this and like being conditioned for so long? And it's an inherent lack of, I would say, this mind, body, spirit connection.
Education.
And education. And that's where you really jumped into the thick of things, right? And I mean, you from Swedish massage, you just carried on.
Yeah. Yep.
And went into so many different modalities, all the way to holographic kinetics. I have zero idea
of
what that is, and I hope we can jump deep into that. What other modalities did you explore? So at 17, you went into Swedish massage. And then from there.
Yeah, I did things like Reiki, you know.
Yeah.
Just stuff that doesn't really work, you know. It's kind of got these little symbols and it's giving energy, and you know, all that stuff that gives and takes energy is the definition of black magic, you know. So I studied about black magic. I got into Aleister Crowley's work, you know, and studied sigil magic, and I wanted to know what I didn't want to practice it. I just wanted to confront it and see what it's about. And so I studied the dark arts. I was a student of plant and animal shamanism for 13 years. I went into many different recesses of my own psyche, my own awareness, and realized that the brain has all the chemistry that all the plants do, except it's a natural chemistry, and plants alter the brain chemistry, where our body's natural state has all the elements, all the alkaloids that we get from these external substances. So I study like everything from Swedish massage to deep tissue, trigger point therapy, myofascial release, Bowen therapy, kinesiology, acupressure, a little bit of acupuncture, Rolfing, some really rigid professional modalities, and some crystal work and feathers and, aromatherapy and, all the funky stuff, you know.
And you weren't doing this to practice, right? You were doing this to extend your knowledge base.
I was practicing.
Oh, were you practicing?
Well, that's how you learn. Yeah? So you learn and then you facilitate. And through the facilitation process, you get to see clients. You get to see how they respond. And then you follow up and you get to see, what they're doing, what they're combining, what else they've done since this treatment. And you get, over many years, you get to see what systems work and what happens when you combine modalities. And I've just with holographic kinetics alone, I've had more than 3,600 clients. You know, I've been a bodywork practitioner for 25 years this year. So I've had thousands and thousands of clients on bodywork. And then holographic kinetics when I turned 30, I found that. And it profoundly changed my life. It was the one thing that really just flipped everything 180, because it showed the causes of my suffering. You know, instead of fluffing around, massaging and sticking needles and things and, you know, putting some nice aromas in the air and all that stuff's nice for the moment. It helps us now, but it doesn't heal the cause of the event, you know. And so holographic kinetics essentially shows us that we, you know, it's an Aboriginal healing modality. And the guy, Steve Richards, who created it, he's a half-caste Aboriginal. He comes from a lineage. His mother is from a lineage of Aboriginal healers, like women's healing.
Yeah.
And he could speak what the Aboriginals call the universal laws. And the laws, L-O-R-E, is, you know, a set of laws or principles that are fundamental for all beings, whether they're electrons, molecules, a firmament, trees, everything in the physical world has these laws, you know. And it's unjudgmental, it's unbiased, it's, you know, based on things like cause and effect. You know, you push something, it moves.
Yeah.
You throw something, it goes there.
Yeah.
If you do something, it will do something. If you don't do something, then it doesn't do something. You know what I mean? Principally, it's very similar to the yin and the yang element, where there's never one force always dominant, you know. Even right now I'm talking, which is quite a yang phase, and you're listening, which is a yin phase, but you're nodding and agreeing. So even though you're yin, you're still putting out yang. And even though I'm in a yang phase, which is talking, I'm still receiving your body language,
how
I'm feeling, changing my posture. So all of it, there's never one dominant force. So it's not based on Taoism, but other cultures have seen these laws as well, and they've applied it to their philosophy. And the indigenous people of Australia, the Aboriginal people, they understood these laws very well. So holographic kinetics, it's called Dreamtime Healing, using holographic kinetics. And it's an understanding that there's two worlds. There's an internal world to an external world. And an external world to the internal world, the way we relate to the world. So the internal world is the dream time. And, you know, we think about our reality and then we make it. You think about making a cake and then you make it. You don't make it and then you think about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. It's the internal world. And so it's the same for everything in the universe. It happens as an internal creation first and then it manifests. This is what the yidiki or the didgeridoo is about. It's about the dream time and making sound, not words or using beta language. It's about just getting in that state of mind and allowing whatever shape comes through, whatever sound comes through. And for the Olna who have, or the Aboriginal people who have the yidiki as their tool, they would shape the land, the landscape, the ecosystem. They would bring the physical world into reality. They would dream it into being. And that's kind of what we do with our voice, yeah? We dream our reality into being through our voice.
Yeah.
So the Aboriginal are called the Yolnu. There's many different cultures, but, you know, each different culture or each different clan within the Aboriginal context, what we call Aboriginal or the First Nations people, you know, the Yolnu are traditionally from the northern part. And there's many different names for the different clans around Australia. But just in this case, Aboriginal is a Latin word, and Yolnu is a word that means the people of this land, essentially. You know, probably means a lot of other things translated depending on the context. So the Aboriginal people, you know, we've got four frequencies of the brain, beta, alpha, theta, delta. So when we, or alpha, beta, theta, delta. When we close our eyes, we activate alpha brainwaves. So the Aboriginal people believe that every living thing has a spirit, a life force known as a spirit. And you can communicate to it. The trees, the rocks, the plants, the animals, the planets.
Yeah.
Every living thing has a life force known or a spirit. So the spirit creates alpha brainwaves. And when you close your eyes, you activate alpha brainwaves, or the alpha brainwaves rise and become dominant. That's the internal world. And The beta brainwaves are the external world, the conscious mind of man, our ego, the way we see the world. When we open our eyes, we receive the inputs of the physical dimension, and beta brainwaves rise, ego gets called into play, and then we're in the external world. Mm. So we have this internal world, or the dream time, and then this external world, which is, you know, the 3D land or the manifestation that we're in now.
Yeah.
And basically, whatever we're projecting from our internal world into 3D land manifests as our reality, as our creation. So it's like your spirit is projecting. It's like the body is a projector. The 3D landscape that we see with our eyes open is like the projector screen.
Yeah.
And whatever the information the spirit has is like the reel or the film. And it projects through the body into the physical world or the hologram.
Yeah.
Okay, so kinetic energy is a free-flowing energy that exists in the universe. If we hang on to it, then it becomes trapped energy. And trapped energy, the universe is always trying to seek its balance. And trapped energy becomes potential energy. Potential energy needs to be released, and that's when we start to see suffering and anger and violence and these things in society, because we're not letting go of our traumas. So we've got this trapped potential energy in our body, in our spirit, which gets trapped in the body in the kinetic form. And then as it's trying to come out, then we have this explosive energy about us. So then we have this internal world, which is alpha, and this external world, which is beta. And that's what the alphabet is, yeah? Alphabet, alpha, beta.
Yeah.
It's a group of letters we put together to externalize our internal world.
God, I've never known that.
And the Aboriginal people are the alpha, beta original people. The original people to master this internal world to the external world. That's the dream time.
Oh, wow.
So whatever happens from this internal to external is what manifests as our reality.
Mm.
So it's very simple to explain now that we've got that out.
Yeah.
Is in that whatever your spirit is holding and projecting is what will manifest.
Yeah.
If you want to change the reality, then we need to change the script. We need to rewrite what is happening here. And that's very simple. It's like we wrote it once. I've got this suffering. So here's a great example. We'll try and make this short. You and I, right, we're out in the street. We're both, like, you know, cruising along. And I might be this, you know, radical vegan activist and all about the animals. And, you know, but whenever I see it, and, like, I love animals, you know, I just, it's all about plants and veganism and, you know, freedom from suffering. But every time I see an elephant, I freak out. My chest gets heavy. My heart starts to race. I lose my breath. We're walking down the street and we see this elephant, right? We see an elephant in the market and I start freaking out. And you're like, Ben, pick yourself up. I may have never seen an elephant before and I love animals, but I'm having this panic attack. My chest is getting heavy. I've got these sweats. And you're not having that reaction. And this happens all the time, you know, like we react to things differently in the external world.
Yeah.
So we can do a session on it and find out that perhaps, and find out that in a past life, for example, I may have been a circus trainer who didn't treat animals very well. And one day the elephant got his own back and stood on my chest. Crushed my chest. As I drew my last breath, I could look into its eyes and it screamed, you know, it made that big noise that they do out of the trunks. And I died feeling like and seeing all the things that I did to these animals. So I died with the suffering. So the spirit is eternal. It's like a highly evolved electron, you know. The sun generates electrons and electrons are virtually immortal. And then we find that, you know, as I was dying, I locked in this trauma. And I could see what I had done, right? So as the spirit evolves, because electrons are virtually immortal, right? So as the spirit evolves and it comes through into the next life, into the next form, it's in its own dimension of time. And the spirit doesn't have past lives and future lives. It's an eternal element. It's an eternal particle. It's both particle and wave. So as it takes on another form, another body, it just projects its reality through that body. So as I come into this life, I'm projecting everything that's ever happened through my other past lives, through the animal kingdom, the firmament, the gases, all the forms of life that I've taken on, are still in the, like, it's like now you can remember a lot of things that have happened to you in this lifetime. So the spirit's the same. It's got all this information, and it takes the external world or the physical world to trigger whatever that whatever the spirit's holding for us to see it. Yeah, so I see the elephant, and I get triggered. We're cruising along. We're having a good day. We're going to hand out some pamphlets, and we're like, hey, guys, you know, there's this, like, new cafe, the Seeds of Life. It's serving good, healthy food. You don't have to eat meat anymore. Go and check it out. You know, we're not going to make you feel guilty about eating animals. You just go and have some good food and see if it's your kind of thing. And then we see this elephant, and I have this reaction. You see, like, everything's sweet, and then all of a sudden the physical world triggers something that's in the spirit. So what holographic kinetics does is find those creation points, and we bring up the emotions and any contracts and agreements, any limiting belief systems that lock in that suffering to be part of a cycle of similarity of the future.
Yeah.
What happens in the past will happen again in the future if we don't make change to it now. So this is the fundamental equation for the spiral, which is the Fibonacci sequence. The past number combined with the present number equals the future number. The past and how we react to it in the present equals the future. And that's a law. That's how life grows. Your limbs are structured by it. The tree's limbs are structured by it. Galactic spirals are structured by the same thing. And as above, so below. As within, so without. The law doesn't change just because we're humans. We'd like it to change. But the way life unfolds from its creation point is the past and how we react to it in the present equal the future. So we just go back and find the issues of the past and we change them in the present. And therefore, every time I see elephants now, I'm all cool with it.
Yeah. And I mean, this it's so fascinating to listen to this and to understand it. And it seems so simple to listen and understand. But I might be a couple steps ahead of trying to go deeper into the spirit side of things. And there's a lot of humans out there, like we've chatted about previously, that are just shut off. They hear this, they shut off. But maybe we can relate to these certain people out there with the methods that you're using. I mean, it's easy to say, let's just shut off and let's not react to something that's our spirit's experienced in the past. But how do we not react? And what kind of methods are you using with clients? Or what kind of methods do you use personally to be able to change the sequence of events?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, like we say my finger, right? We don't say I finger. In the same way we say my scooter. We don't say I scooter. We say my body. You know, this is my possession. It's not who I am, it's my possession. So we already know that we're in the body. It's in our language. We accept it. Now, if you're going to push against this information and now run around and keep saying I body, it's just going to sound weird. Mm. It doesn't fit in with, you know, what's congruent. So we are in the body, but we're not the body. So we're using the body, which is kinetics and the study of kinesiology, to access this internal information. So you're as conscious as you are now, but with your eyes closed, and this is what activates or gives rise to predominant alpha brainwaves. And with holographic kinetics, we're trained to simply ask questions and not interject with our own beliefs or interpretations and just listen to what the client is saying. So when a client is talking, so you're on the table with your eyes closed and I'm asking certain questions, which are, for example, we could just ask you, what's the priority issue affecting the running of the being in present day? So we've all got a lot of issues, but what's the number one? What's the priority? And then we've got an emotion, an emotional chart. It's got two sides, A to Z of emotions. And each category, there's like A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4 in each letter. And there's 10 emotions in each box. So through kinesiology, which is muscle testing, I'm saying, what's the priority issue affecting the governing, what's the priority issue affecting the running of the being in present day? And then we need to ask, what's the priority emotion that's governing that? So the emotion is like a key. For me, it's the elephant. It's the emotion around the elephant. Fear, and it might be guilt, shame. So the emotion might be guilt. So we'll be muscle testing, and we've got the agreement to do the work. And then we're going through, is it on page one, muscle test? Is it on page two, muscle test? If it's on page two, is it in section E, F, G, or H? So we go to, you know, section G. Is it G1, G2, G3, or G4? So we muscle test again, and this might be G4. Okay, and is it the first five of those 10, or is it the second five of those 10? We muscle test, and it might be G4, number 8, and the emotion is guilt. It's the priority emotion. It's the priority. It's the number one emotion that when I feel guilt, when I'm cruising through my day, and all of a sudden, and we all do this, we cruise through life, life gets good, and then we have these like right angle kind of shifts, and we backtrack a little bit, and we very rarely do many people really gain this beautiful momentum. And momentum is the driving force of manifestation. You know, it's once the momentum is running, then we get in the flow state. But the thing that pulls us out of a flow state is these emotions that trigger us. So we've got to find these emotions that trigger us and, you know, sidetrack us. Sideswipe us off our off our day. You don't have to be a spiritual person or a person who believes in past lives or future lives to know that that's happening to you. Life is good. All of a sudden, something hits you from the side. You weren't aware of it. You don't even know what it is. But we can find out that there's an emotion through muscle testing, that there's an emotion, and let's say it's guilt. And very many, many times I will just say, okay, thank you, Spirit, that we've got the emotion of guilt. At what age did you first experience guilt in this lifetime? Muscle testing, we'll go down and we'll find that maybe it was at the age of 4. Straight away the client starts crying. What's going on? I'm sitting at the dinner table. I don't like Brussels sprouts. My father smashes me over the ear again with his hand, telling me, I'm never going to amount to anything. I've got to eat my Brussels sprouts, do what I'm told, blah, blah, blah. All right, how does that make you feel? More crying. The person will afterwards say, wow, I really felt my ear get hot in that session. The memory's still there. The trauma's still there in the kinetic world, in the electrons, in the physical world. Spirit's hanging on to it, and then it projects it. It's like, oh, that's right, and it projects it out of that place where the trauma is. What other emotions are you feeling? Disappointed? Why are you feeling disappointed, Spirit? Well, I just want my father to show me some respect. I don't like Brussels sprouts. Why do I have to eat these things? You know, why can't he give me a good, decent explanation? Why can't he talk to me about, you know, I need protein and I need, you know, plants, sustenance, and, you know, I need amino acids and vitamin C, and I need all of these things that are in Brussels sprouts. Why doesn't he give me the proper rundown? Why does he have to bash me all the time? I just want to love my father. You know, oh, okay, so now we go a little bit deeper. I just want to love my father. How does it feel to have your father treat you like this? We just dive deeper. Up come the emotions. Come in the present day, and we'll find that maybe that person doesn't treat their child very good either. And so this is, and then we'll go into past life stuff, you know, afterwards. Say, right, so when on your time, like, when, Spirit, when was the first time you first experienced this emotion of guilt? So we clear the trauma in a whole other, like, just by.
And going through it, does that clear the trauma in essence?
Yes, it does, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like, I carried a lot of stuff, you know, and I thought I'd got through a lot of stuff, but this system is what actually gave me the. And so, yeah, I mean, I cleared my stuff. This is how I know it works. Because I'm here today, 13 years later, still in that flow state, still in that momentum. You saw the other night the manifestation of what happens when someone clears all the shit that they've been hanging on to, because I really wanted to make change in the world, but I couldn't get through a few things. There was just something inside of me. I'd worked so hard. I'd taken every substance, seen every freaking healer and I did everything and I still didn't get to that deeper wound, and I knew it was there, and I knew there was something I just couldn't access. And I went to see this guy, and in 5 minutes I was crying, I had mucus dripping out of every orifice, all over his hand. And afterwards, after the session, I got up and I felt, you know, compelled to study this modality, because I had a real issue. And he took me to these moments with my mother. He took me to these moments with my family, these things where I felt my family weren't doing the right thing. You know, my spirit was not in alignment with my family's actions. And I had carried this stuff around. And as a result, I was going to manifest that in the future, because I was holding it. I was going to poison my future timeline as a result of hanging on to it. And we cleared that stuff, and I ended up doing the training 2 weeks later. And then over time, I started to see that I wasn't reacting to the external world in the way that I was. Life would come along and present itself in the way that it did, and I would just simply, just move aside from it. Not intentionally, not like, oh, here it comes, I'm not reacting to that again. I just wouldn't be in that place when life was challenging me. So I call this like the compounding interest of the work that's being done. After you cruising through the city and there's no red lights, you know, in your big truck, 23-24 gear truck, and you're just in top gear, you don't have to work down the gears anymore, you're not getting sideslapped by these triggers in life, because there's nothing inside that's being triggered anymore. I mean, there's still things that come up, but there's just so much momentum now that you can look at these things and step on it with the front foot and go, all right, and you take it in your stride, and you look at it while you're powering through life, rather than like having to stop and go inward and I need to take time off and, you know, I need to look at all this stuff. And, you know, now it's just, it's really, it's the work that you see. It's years after working with clients that I get to see the work that's been done, because you can do the work and like half the work's done on the table, but it's then seeing what changes take place,
the momentum that builds up.
Exactly, yeah, because we're not reacting to life in that way anymore. All those triggers that were holding us back aren't there anymore, and in fact we can think about what we want to do, get the ball in motion, and then the ball starts rolling. It doesn't get like sideswiped.
This is the most interesting modality I've ever laid my ears on. How can people take it further? I mean, obviously, if they're in a boot, they can maybe come speak to you. But or do you practice out of here, or are there recommended resources maybe that people could?
Yeah, so it's holographickinetics.com. And the teacher's name's Steve Richards, the author. And, you know, he's studied body electronics, radionics, hypnotherapy, lots of things, you know, outside the field, you know, and he's trained a lot of people around the world, so he can let any of your listeners know if there's a facilitator near them.
And then
they don't have to believe in the spirit.
Yeah.
It's not about whether our ego believes that there's past lives or not. And the reality is there are no past lives. It's just the spirit just lives on, changes its clothing like we change ours. And you don't even have to, like, if you want to look at what issues you might be carrying from this lifetime, you go and have a session. You don't have to believe that you have a spirit for it to work, because it's not healing the ego of its belief systems, yeah, that society has given us. Like a child isn't born racist, and a child isn't born, you know, eating meat, and the child isn't born doing all of these things. Society conditions us to think a certain way, and a lot of people's intelligence gets in the way of their own evolution, because, you know, we often think that we're smarter than what we really are. So just going and having a session with an open mind that there is something out there in the world that's more than what we can understand. You know, the universe is vastly different to what we have been conditioned or trained to think it is. And anyone who thinks they've got a good handle on it, you know, probably hasn't.
Yeah.
And even those of us who've spent most of our lives studying it, the more you get into it, the more you realize that there are so many possibilities out there that even though you could read every science fiction book ever written, and you'd still think that that's like 0.5% of all the potential. There's so many possibilities out there, so many dimensions, like your thoughts and emotions. You can't cut the body open to see them. Sure, you can see heat and you can see color, but you can't see your thoughts. I can't see words and I can't see your feelings. They exist in a different dimension. So you're in different dimensions as much as you're in this dimension. You exist in other dimensions. The heat, you know, it comes from, you know, your emotions, how you feel about your environment.
You know. Wow, this is, I cannot wait to explore this even further. This is, I mean, it's safe to say from the history you've told me about to the holographic kinetics and how it works on you to Saturday night when I was at your Seeds of Life graduation party, it's safe to say that your trajectory and your ball has been rolling into a bigger snowball. And I mean, I was chatting to Bobby, one of your students.
Oh, Bobby, yeah.
And I said to Bobby, and he's like, cool, he's very vibrant, you know. And I was like, Bobby, you're a chef, or like, what's happening? He's like, no, someone suggested I do this. Like, I'm so keen on nutrition. And everything I thought this was going to be, it was just way bigger. Mm. And I'm going to get goosebumps saying this, because it's just the change that you are creating in the world with this mindset. Because a lot of people have got this reductionist mindset, right? So they've got reductionism, so they go into food, and yeah, it's just food.
Yeah.
But it's the whole healing properties of the nutrients within foods and nutrient-dense foods and the aliveness that we lack in this world. And I saw it from the foods that came out, whether it was the table that was prepared by your staff or the table prepared by your students, to us all joining hands and you leading us into receiving the food. Well, just to the conscious crowd that was there. And I was like, wow, I still say to my girlfriend, Claire, like, the space that Ben's created here is so needed in this world. And I have so much gratitude for it. You haven't just got here. Like, so, I mean, your step into nutrition, your step into food, you've always been in the hospitality industry.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I started in kitchens when I was 14. I got my first job. You were legally allowed to work when you were 14 and a half in Australia.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I got a job that day. My grandmother was a professional chef. She took care of me after my mother passed away. And I was inspired by, even like every night that she would prepare food, it was, you know, plated really nicely and it was really clean food. And because I was a runner and triathlete, I was, you know, aware of how foods made me feel and, you know, running on a full belly and training after eating and all those things. You know, I had the body awareness around, you know, food a little bit, but then...
Were you vegetarian, vegan then already?
No, not at all. I mean, that veganism is not something, or vegetarianism isn't something that's really in my family. It was... my grandmother, she had a great influence on me in that area where she would just disappear for the day. You know, I'd be at school and she'd go and do a thing and she'd come home and I had no idea what she was doing in her job, but I knew she was a professional chef and she would present some of that on the table. And then I went to work in a restaurant and, you know, we were doing roast chicken and roast vegetables and things like that and, you know, nuggets and stuff. It was kind of like a big rooster kind of thing, you know, and just a fast food place. But it was a kitchen. It had rotisseries and deep fryers and cool rooms and I kind of got a little feel for that and then it's after my grandmother kicked me out of home and
at what age was that?
I was like 16, well 15 and a half. She went into hospital. Well, she gave up smoking cigarettes and she got really sick. She had angina and she had like 8 angina attacks in one morning. And then that freaked me out a bit. I took myself out of school. I was 15. Took myself out of school to go full time because needed to earn some money, right? I wasn't sure if my grandmother was going to like even survive hospital or whatever. So yeah, once she got out of hospital, I said, "Oh yeah, by the way, I'm not at school anymore." And she just nearly had another heart attack. And she said, "Right, you're out of control. You've got to." So she kind of set me up with a little unit with my cousin, and she said, "You're out. you know, and then it was about a year and a half later, 2 years later or something, she passed away and left me with that imprint of chefing, you know, and preparing food and what it feels like to eat good food. Even though it was meat, it was still good food. It was love. You know, she came from the Great Depression and she had this idea that if the family can sit down and have it, share a good meal together, then, you know, you're ahead in life. Because that, you know, around that end of the Second World War was really tough, you know. And so she kind of put that energy into me, you know, with that idea, that concept, that she instilled that energy within me to, you know, that there's something about feeding people. And so then I got a job in a bar, a bikies bar, in the daytime, and then I was working at nighttime.
Oh, that's an experience.
Yeah, it was an experience, yeah. It was out of control. And then I just went on that radical kind of path, but I stayed in hospitality. It was easy to get work. I was a keen worker and moved to the Gold Coast and met a girl who was working in five-star hotels in the casino on the Gold Coast in the fine dining restaurant, and she was a beautiful girl. And she had it together as well. So she'd like to party a little bit. She was studying and she was working in this. And so I was like, she likes to party a bit. She has a good time, but she studies and she works in a really fancy restaurant. So it's like another level above working in bikey bars and, you know, working in dirty kitchens. So I luckily fell into this. I applied for this hospitality course, which I had no idea what it was going to be like. I got it for free. It was a $15,000 three-month course. It gave me a certificate in basic cookery, certificate 3 in basic cookery and hospitality, and I learned about, you know, I got an entry-level certificate into being a croupier and lots of things. It was an incredible opportunity. It was one of these gifts, and I had really long hair at that time and hadn't shaved for a long time. And the teacher, I got the top level, the top scores in the class, you know, and the teacher said, you know, if you clean yourself up a bit, I'll get you a job in one of the five-star hotels on the Gold Coast. So I did, and she did, and that was it. You know, I kind of, from there, I could get any job I applied for anywhere and continued to work in both the restaurant, in fine dining restaurants, in really fun but dirty little Italian pizza joints, you know, yeah, that were open late at night that were just really groovy, great music, and all the hospitality crew would sort of sign off their jobs and come into these little pizza houses and get really messy and, you know, and then so I'd work there and I'd work in the, you know, like a fine dining restaurant in the nighttime and then go work in these little restaurants, you know, from sort of 11 or 12 o'clock until 3 o'clock, you know. Yeah. Just like my girlfriend at the time did, you know, she had this contrast. And so then I was still interested in the healing modalities and I was using the money to study with different people, and I ended up with a Land Rover, a 75 Series 3 Land Rover, and put solar power on it and had a trailer with a kitchen in it and just traveled Australia for 11 years doing vision quests in the desert and studying from different people and working in little eco lodges and
amazing. So you were like kind of like a cafe on the go, kitchen on the go?
No, it was my own kitchen. So I would just, yeah, I would go and do like 40 days in the desert, 60 days in the desert on my own, just do vision quests and travel and go and pick fruit and go out and work in hotels or bars, or there's a fine dining restaurant in the desert that I went and worked at. You know, and then there was people that I could go and study and learn from. And then I was just following the seasons around in Australia. I'd go up north for winter and down south for summer, and that was the routine. And then I'd go to festivals, and then I got into herbs, you know, like the plant, the plant world, you know.
Yeah, where was your actual transition into, I mean, you did this now for 11 years, where was your transition into finding, taking your love of chefing now and the hospitality industry into your passion and purpose in herbs and teas and the plant world, veganism, vegetarian, into like alive foods? What was that? Was it quite like a slow transition, or was it quite a wake-up call?
It was kind of in my early to mid-20s, and I met a guy, and he was vegetarian. He was just telling me that he'd been vegetarian his whole life, and it kind of just made sense. And then I was like, all right, if I'm going to be vegetarian, if I'm going to eat, you know, I can do that. But if I'm going to eat meat, I'm going to go and hunt my own. And it was when I was hunting some friends, you know, we'd go out at night with the guns and go and get these, what this guy was calling pests, you know, wild goats and rabbits off his land, right? And so I'd go hunting with these guns, and it was when I was skinning a goat and pulling its guts out and watching, you know, bleeding these animals, you know, it was and this rabbit, you know, shot this rabbit and had to break its neck to kill it, you know, and then skinning it, and the whole thing, it just made me sick, you know. I was like, I can't do this. What am I doing? This is not. So then I was like, all right, I'm obviously not a hunter. I'm not going to eat meat, but I was still fishing. I was like, somehow I didn't make the connection that fish were part of that, and didn't jump on that, like, you know, vegan thing. Everyone's bad. You've got to change your world. Like, never into that kind of message. You know, I was just, all right, if you can do it, then it's for you. If you can't do it, it's not for you. But if you can't do it, don't go and buy the stuff off supermarket shelves, you know, like. And then I was free diving for crayfish one time, and a crayfish wouldn't come out of its rock ledge, and put my knife out, and I was really deep, and I was almost out of breath, and it wouldn't come out, and I kept stabbing it in the face, and I was like, come on, you got to come out, I'm running out of breath. And I caught myself with what I was doing to this animal. It didn't want to come out. You know, it was like my spirit was saying, this is not right. Like, what are you doing? And it was just my conditioning that I was working through. I was getting through the cultural conditioning, working through all the layers of what our culture says, you know, that everything in the universe is us to consume, right? Mm. You put it all in your mouth and crap it out. That's what we humans do. You know, we chew and we poo.
Yeah.
Now we're going to the moon to find things to chew and poo, you know, like that's, and I nearly choked on my food, you know, on my water, sorry. And anyway, so I ended up, because I'd made a mess of this crayfish, ended up getting him out, and we ate it that night, and that was it. I wasn't going to eat it anymore, you know, out of respect for the animal. We ate it that night, and it was the next week, you know, I had a big dose of magic mushrooms. You know, I was like 26 or something. And I'd cut these branches down around our house because a couple of people, I lived in a tree house in the Daintree Rainforest. A couple of people had died from staph in the house. And it was because there wasn't sunlight getting into the house. So I cut a few trees down. We're in the rainforest, right? So I cut a few trees down just where the sun, on the sun's track. And I kind of used this bluntish machete, and they weren't clean cuts. Didn't think anything of it, you know. I thought I was doing the right thing for us. But when I had this huge dose of magic mushrooms and the tree started, I could feel it talking to me. And I was like, I see all this red coming out of where I'd cut the branches just, you know, the day before, a couple of days before. And
yeah.
The tree had said, you know, this wasn't clean. You didn't do this clean. You didn't make an offering. What were you doing, you know? It's like, well, I didn't want. And they're talking to this tree, and I'm like, didn't want people to die. And the tree's like, yeah, well, it was teaching me beautifully.
Hmm.
It's getting my ass kicked, you know, emotionally. But it was teaching me beautifully. It was like, you know, yeah, when you do something like this, yeah, we've got no elders in our society. Yeah, we've got no one to tell us how to teach us how to do these things, perform these rites of passage, you know. We've got no one to show us this stuff. So there, the tree was my teacher, and I. And then afterwards, you know, I went down, I took some hair out of my head and buried it at the roots of the tree, and I prayed for it. I said, look, I'm really sorry. You know, thank you for, you know, your lessons. I was upstairs again, and I had some more mushroom tea, and I was like, I got through that, and I was like, I'm starting to feel light again, and felt good about myself again, you know. Felt the tree had forgiven me, and then the tree started talking to me again. He was like, and about the animals, you know, the energy that's in the food becomes the energy of your body.
Mm.
And it started teaching me about the things we put in our body and how it changes the subtle energy of our mind and our body. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to clean my diet up. I'm going to clean my life up as well. And, you know, slowly started working over the next couple of years to clean all of those substances out of my life as well. So it showed me that, I saw the information, the subtle energy of, you know, the food we eat going into my body like it was like a projector. It got into my behind my eyelids, and I couldn't see the world around me. I just had this vision of the information of the food, particularly it was meat. And even though I made the decision to stop eating meat, it was teaching me. It was like I was ready to understand the process of what happened.
Yeah.
And that was the motivator. I was like, well, I'm not eating meat again. But I was happy eating, you know, eggs. I wasn't into dairy because I had, you know, allergies when I was younger. So I wasn't really into dairy. But I was happy to eat, you know, what I thought were free-range eggs. And then it was when I turned 30, I found holographic kinetics. And then that helped me really look at the reasons why I was taking these substances, you know, why I thought I needed mescaline and peyote and, you know, mushrooms and DMT and all of these things that got me to find answers to questions that nobody could answer. You know, eventually it was like, yeah, I don't need that now, and I can start letting go of that stuff and really going into my own physiology. And then I found yoga, found Ashtanga yoga and pranayama. And they, you know, the breath.
So powerful.
And it's all in the breath. I mean, we are drugs, right? And yeah. And I kept getting those messages on the last sort of couple of years of my journeys. It was like, I don't need this anymore. I'm going to have to stop it if I want to. And then Saturn return hit, you know. Saturn return was really gnarly.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, you're going to keep doing the same things over and over again. We're going to change. Regular stuff. And I decided that I wanted to change the way I was doing things. And then holographic kinetics just appeared. Pretty much 3 days after my 14th of August, which was my birthday. And then, yeah, as soon as Saturn return was over, it was bang. It's opportunity for a new life came along.
Yeah.
Then, and it was not long after that I became, I was in Tasmania. I was working in the wilderness there, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was on the internet looking for modalities to learn, you know, what was next. And nutrition came up. I saw David Wolf on YouTube, and he was, you know, going on about Rudolf Steiner, which I'd worked on permaculture farms and heard stories about, and about the connection to the living foods and living bodies and the life force in the enzymes and, you know, biological energy there that's available, and our bodies transmutate that. And I already had that download. I already got my ass kicked by the tree spirit, you know, like I got that. Didn't have to be on drugs to work that one out anymore. And I was like, all right, so raw foods it is. Started eating more raw foods, learned a little bit about it. Was working in a eco lodge, you know, and then was looking at where in Australia I could learn about raw foods. And, you know, California was so far ahead of the game back in those days. Even now, like, Australia's really slow catching up with it. There are people living it, you know. There are people who've been living living foods diet for, you know, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Not many people in Australia were doing that intelligently that I knew of. There wasn't a movement. There were people who were kind of doing it, but there wasn't, like, Excalibur dehydrators and Vitamix blenders and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, David Wolf obviously bought, you know, connection to superfoods out. And you know, he went too far, David Wolf, you know. He's, like, a great marketer and money and fame and all that stuff's a big lure. But I still think he's done more for the health of humans than any other one individual, you know. So I've got a lot of respect for that, you know, and decided to learn more about it. And the only place in Australia that was doing raw foods was a place in Western Australia, in Dunsborough, near Margaret River, and it's called Samudra. So I applied for a job there and became the manager of that place. And it was a vegan place that did raw food and had an Ashtanga yoga studio.
Oh, cool.
Biodynamic farm. You know, we were growing 70 and 80 kilogram pumpkins just with biodynamics.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and I just had, and because I was frothing on something new to learn, I just sponged it all up, sponged everything that goji berries did, everything that maca does, everything that lucuma does. It turns out that the place that I was at, Samudra, I did 2 retreats for David Wolf because they invited him over. So the guy who got me inspired ended up doing retreats for him. You know, I was the guy doing the smoothie demos and then catering and writing, you know, menus and recipes, and then getting people doing these 1 month workshops. You know, you come 2 times a week for 3 hours. People were driving 300 kilometers for these workshops, you know, and I was like, what's going on? Why does that so much enthusiasm? And I was frothing on it. And at the same time, I transitioned to 100% raw. I found the Chinese tonic herbs at the same time because I had a damn spleen and learned all about spleen health and found astragalus and it transformed my physiology. So then I could have 100% raw food and have my, you know, spleen health and have healthy digestion. And that was the two things. And then I started to teach other people about it. And then people were saying, oh, you know, you should do something more. You should do something bigger. And then Bali came up. So I came over to Bali and started teaching for other people when I was here and doing retreats, assisting on people's retreats, and met a woman and we started doing our own retreats and our own trainings, and here I am.
What a journey. If there's ever been less of an overnight success story, you're living it. We're living it.
Yeah,
it's a testament, and I really am grateful for what you have created in Bali, but moreover in the world. I mean, I've heard about your brand way before I had intentions of coming to Bali.
Cool.
And you've got to try and, with fear of getting too close to the marketing, the tainting of marketing, that your raw food course has generated momentum all over the world. I mean, I don't know of many other ones that have such high reputation, high accreditation. Amazing. So well done.
Thank you.
It's incredible. And the foods that you've turned out, but the foods that your students turn out, is just testament of what a great teacher you are.
Yeah.
Like, it really is. I kept saying the whole night on Saturday nights. Well, when I first came here, the first meal I ever had out of your creations was the gnocchi.
The
gorgonzola.
Oh, right.
And I was like,
you like that one, huh? That's good. Like,
I couldn't believe it.
It's a little wild, you know, the wild noni, spirulina, fermented blue cheese kind of taste.
It blew my mind back. I mean, my taste buds have kind of adapted. So, So Claire's a full-on vegan chef, like kind of fine dining vegan chef, and she loves these stronger tastes. Got my bitter taste buds going.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was ready for it.
Yeah, great.
I jumped in and we were both like, this is mad.
Yeah, yeah, it's mad. It's crazy how Noni does gorgonzola flavor, and you know, you don't
it's
have
so
to do
cool,
much, living
and
food.
You don't have to like cook the. It's a new concept for me, like raw foods, you know, like raw foods for me, like I love fruits and I love, you know, like salads and that, but when you put it together in dishes like you have, it breaks that conditioning. So for me, I had a bit of conditioning broken here, like eating here.
Yeah.
The menu is expansive. Your retreats, I'm sure, are expansive. What is one meal that you have been itching to replicate from a cook point of view? Do you have a meal that you haven't perfected yet?
It's like things like soufflés, you know, that crunchy outside, soft, warm and runny inside, you know. I know people like Matthew Kenny, you know, they get into this sort of gastronomy kind of, and they kind of play with things like that. So they're probably going to bring it out, you know, like, you know, I don't know. I don't even know if it can be done. I'm not interested in gastronomy. I love it. I love watching people do it. I appreciate it, but it's a little too processed, and things like biophotons and enzymes are kind of really compromised, and it's not. But if it can be done, you know, I've just got to find that molecule in nature that is soft like an Irish moss, is soft when you blend it, but then can dehydrate and be crunchy and crackly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, stuff that with something so then it dehydrates, but then it's got to expand. And souffle is the one, you know, the thing with the gnocchi is, you know, it mimics, and I personally think the texture is better than the potato one because I use cauliflower and psyllium husk. So it's good for your colon as well. It's a colon cleanser as well. So it's incredibly good for your immune system because the noni. And then it's got the psyllium husk, which is a great, you know, cleanser and detoxifier. So that's kind of that's the trajectory I take with preparing food, is like, how is it both nutritious and healthy and cleansing and detoxifying and healing at the same time? How do we deliver and eliminate without accumulating? So they're the kind of elements I like to play with when I'm, you know, delivering food. Because I don't think the world needs another restaurant. Definitely not in Ubud. There's more than 700 on TripAdvisor, you know, like.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This is the only 100% raw food restaurant in Indonesia. There's other places that are like a salad bar and a juice bar, but in terms of entrees, mains, and desserts, table service, like we've got a cocktail bar here from fermented drinks and tonic teas and extracts and that. So it's a full restaurant. It's like an a la carte restaurant. So I'm trying to reinvent the way we do restaurants.
Mm.
That is, you come into a restaurant, you've got music, you've got a la carte service, the bill comes to your table, but then that whole thing is like, oh yeah, that's gnocchi, that's lasagna, that's, but then it does all of these other incredible things at the same time. So, you know, I don't know how that, making a souffle, I don't know how that, if I can find that element that brings those nutritive qualities to the table, then I'm definitely interested. But I don't try to, that's what I'm thinking of. I'm not thinking of, oh, look, there's a roast lamb. How do I recreate roast lamb? I'm thinking of nutritional profile, what the body kind of, what the standard kind of diet needs replacing. And then I come up with options around that.
Yeah.
I might choose an ethnic flavor or an ethnic, classic ethnic dish to play with as a delivery system for that.
What's your favorite ingredient in your raw kitchen, should I say? Like a must for you?
Mm.
If any, because you use thousands.
I mean, coconut aminos. Yeah, I don't like using salt so much. I mean, the average palate has salt and sugar as, so you've got to kind of meet those requirements. And coconut aminos is both sweet and salty. Aged miso. You know, I don't mind if it's good quality organic soybeans that's aged. We've got a lady here in Ubud, a Japanese lady, who ages her miso, and it's organic. It's incredibly good quality. You know, these are little flavor additions. I think, like, if you add 5-7% of a recipe that isn't raw, like if herbs and spices, things that are cooked, things that are roasted, miso, shoyu, these kind of things need to be added for people to. But when you start going north of 7-10% or 20% of a recipe, then it's not raw. Then, in my mind, it's kind of, it's an almost raw dish, you know. And so coconut aminos are just fermented. Nama shoyu, you know, which is just fermented soybeans, unpasteurized. Those kind of things that add to the aged miso is like a living probiotic. The soybeans being cooked, of course, but it's been brought back to life with a koji or a culture starter. So it is living. You can make cheese out of it. You can make, you know, really nice salty flavors, nice spreads and salad dressings. So I think a really good aged miso, coconut aminos or nama shoyu, they're the most versatile. Not super exciting. They're not like, oh, yeah, wow, that's a great thing. Just versatile, but serve their multi-purpose. You know what I mean? They're very...
Yeah, that's super interesting, yeah.
Educational as well. When people hear about that, they're like, oh, I didn't know nama shoyu was, you know, 18 months aged in oak barrels, non-pasteurized, fermented, you know. So those are the kind of things I like. I just eat a lot of fruit myself, so it's got to have mango and pineapple.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, like, I couldn't... The food was incredible on Saturday night, but I couldn't eat like that every night. It's like raw food in fine dining can be quite rich.
Yeah.
And like you, yeah, you actually mentioned on the night that this is a transition.
Yeah.
Raw food. What's your diet like? Like, what do you eat? Just lots of fruits?
I'm fasting anywhere between sort of 14, 16 hours to 20 hours a day. And I'll eat a bowl. I do a 2.5 to 3 hour yoga pranayama practice in the morning, and then I'll eat a mango, some pineapple, and 4 scoops of coconut ice cream. And that's it, man. That's pretty much it. Every other day I'll have a meal, you know, if I lose that satiated feeling, that, like,
yeah.
You know, I'm kind of, it's gone from, you know, vegetarian to vegan, 80% raw, 100% raw, 100% raw and gourmet. You're still trying to get those comfort foods, and then those comfort foods have, like, eased off, and eating 3 meals a day to 2 meals a day, 2 meals a day to 1 meal a day plus fruit, 1 meal a day plus fruit, plus down to just a bowl of mango and some pineapple and 4 scoops of coconut ice cream. That's kind of like my go-to. And if I get hungry again in the afternoon, I'll just have another bowl of mango and pineapple and coconut ice cream.
Yeah.
And every other day, I'll have a meal, you know, and it'll be like the curried pizza here that's got lots of sprouted seeds in it, you know, so sprouted, activated seeds, marinated vegetables in a really nice nutrient-rich sauce, or the aloe vera sashimi,
yeah.
You know, which is...
It's incredible.
You know, it's just... but it's every other day, you know, and it's
what's the reason for that? Like, for decreasing the amount of meals that you've eaten to the point where you are now, is that just...
I don't know. I hadn't planned it. I love food. I've got a restaurant. Yeah. Can you imagine a restaurateur sitting down talking like this to people saying, you're eating too much, don't eat so much food?
Yeah.
And people are like, yeah, but I just love your food. And say, like, yeah, well, okay. I don't know what to do, but, you know, we're eating too much. It's, I don't know, from what I feel, it's been an 11-year process on this raw food journey, you know, starting out sort of 80% raw. No, 80% raw is, you know, from what I was experiencing was, you know, breakfast and lunch and snacks raw and just cooked dinner. Did that for a couple of years and then decided one summer, once I was teaching people how to make raw food and I had a few recipes, to just do raw food all summer. And I felt incredible. So I decided to keep doing it through winter. And then, you know, I had a couple of warm miso soups through winter, but they weren't boiled. I was keeping the integrity of the miso. Beans and then so that first winter I got through, but I was like, oh, I did miss the raw food, the warm food for comfort reasons. And I was like, then I got the emotional connection to food. I was like, all right, there's definitely something emotional there. I don't want to be driven by my emotions. I don't want to be eating out of emotional kind of control or addictions. It was a slow journey, you know. I just had realizations of what I was doing. Didn't know the fix or that I had to fix anything. And I've been a big proponent of fasting, you know, since I was 24 when I started taking San Pedro.
Yeah,
it taught me about, you know, emptying the body and how things want the body on their own terms. You know, kind of gnarly when you think of it that way, but that's what they do, you know, and half your trip on those things is the plant fighting the crap that's in our body so it can have your body on its own terms, yeah? And so I got that when I was younger, and so I would fast before I'd do these vision quests. And then as I was getting into the raw food thing, obviously fasting and detoxification comes up. So then I got into shoving hoses and water up my bum and all these things in my body and scrubbing my skin with all this stuff and doing all these different cleanses and just getting cleaner and clearer and feeling lighter and better. And, you know, you jump on a weak juice fast and you get to day 5 or whatever and your skin's glowing, your eyes are shining, and you feel great. And you're like, what do I need to eat for? This is ridiculous. And, of course, after a while you start questioning, oh, I might die. Or friends say, geez, you haven't eaten for a while. You should eat something. And, of course, the conditioning kicks in harder than your drive, and you start eating again. And, you know, I've done now more than 70 fasts, up to 30 days on water, and just found that the more efficient and the more obstructions I move from my body, the less I need to eat, because my body can use those nutrients more efficiently because the processes of assimilation and digestion are more efficient, you know, I've done the E. Cornell plant-based nutrition course with Colin Campbell, right? And, you know, they go into talking about even if you eat a big bowl of salad, your body might not need any of the nutrients in that salad, because most of us in the West, in the privileged world, we're not deficient in nutrients. It's just we have a problem with assimilation, not deficiency. So I was like, right, okay, I get that now. It's about nutrient density and efficiency combined. It's not about what I'm eating. It's is my body in the right state to assimilate the nutrients? And that's what that activation is at the dinner that night, was, you know, getting people aware that, and the body aware that, hey, there's nutrients coming in. Get ready to assimilate. You know, forget about the day. Forget about your stresses. Get out of that fight or flight thing that we get into, that mode, and get into a more present embodied state where your body can just relax and absorb nutrients. Because if we're under any stress, if there's cortisol, the body's not going to take on nutrients. It's going to protect itself. And it's not in a phase of, you know, kicking back and soaking up the nutrients. It doesn't want to digest anything. Animals don't stop. You try and feed your cat or your dog when it's like stressed out, there's no way it's going to eat. So they just naturally know, like, our bodies are the same. So the more I got into that, that's why I'll eat after I practice yoga, you know, because I'm super chill. Channels are open. Metabolism's fired up. I drop a little bit of fruit on there and boom, I'm going all day, you know. As well as the cultivation of the prana in the practice and the mobilization of this prana and chi, you know, efficiently. Everything is energy, right? Everything isn't food. It's just energy. So what I'm feeling is that the more efficient my body gets, the cleaner, more obstructions I remove, the less I need to eat. And so I'm just doing that. I have an incredible menu. I make some incredible things that I love. Like I just make the food that I like to eat and serve it, and people like it.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a recipe I learned from a chef many years ago. You know, he was one of those classical chefs where he was angry at everyone and used to, any customer that had a problem with his food, he'd just tell them to leave.
Yeah.
Well, don't pay your bill, just get out of here. You got a problem with how I make the food, get out of here.
Yeah.
Pretty radical. But, like, there's nothing wrong with my food, you know. Everyone else here likes it except for you.
Mm.
I don't want you in my restaurant. You know, I don't have that attitude, but I'm like, but it was like, yeah, he's right. He's an artist. You know, an artist doesn't paint food. An artist doesn't paint their paintings to please everyone.
Of course.
An artist paints what they paint. And if people like it, you know, there's people who are going to like it and there's people who won't. You can't go around pleasing everyone. So what's the best formulation? Do you try to make food to please everyone, or do you make food that makes you happy? That makes you feel good. And that can be junk food. People get, look at McDonald's, you know, look at these places. People make that food because it makes them feel good. Feeling good's feeling good. It's relative to where you're at, yeah? If you're on the junk food thing, or if you're in this, you know, super light intermittent fasting thing, whatever food makes you feel good, you're just going to resonate with that. We look at the McDonald's, we're like, nah, that's, you know, McDonald's look at us and go, there's no way. Where do you get your protein from? All these silly things. But we're just in different ends of the spectrum, yeah? We're just like different realities.
Mm.
So just making food that makes me feel good, that I like, that tastes good to me, and then knowing that, okay, most people are going to come into the restaurant, have a sweet palate anyway. They like more junky combinations. And then I kind of just tweak it a little bit to fit that, because I also, if I just serve mango, pineapple, and ice cream on my menu, I probably wouldn't have many customers, right?
Yeah, that's cool. I tried your tiramisu the other day.
Pretty awesome, huh?
Yeah, it's gnarly.
Really light.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I love about the food, right? It's because you walk away. You know, like I was saying the other time, every Christmas time, for some reason, everyone binges on Christmas Day. And the next day you feel like...
Yeah.
I've kind of felt it on Saturday night. It was like Christmas time, Christmas feast on everything.
Yeah.
Tried every dish. You know?
Yeah.
Got home later and I'm like, quite comfy.
Yeah.
I can go home and sleep, you know? That's pretty cool. I've got two more questions for you to end off. You live on this side of the world where there is a lot of Ayurvedic, and I know in your tea menu there's Ayurvedic tonics, etc. What is your answer, shall I say, to people saying raw food doesn't fit in my dosha or my body doesn't accept raw food?
That's a really good question. You know, people who say that haven't read the manuscripts. The subtle energy of your food becomes the subtle energy of your mind. That comes from the Upanishads. That's the Vedic knowledge. They talk about only eating raw food. They talk about only eating living foods. The living energy of the food becomes the living energy of your mind. There's nowhere in the Chinese system or the Ayurvedic system that says don't eat raw food. That's a misinterpretation, and people will apply that because, yeah, people eat raw foods and they're weak. Most humans are weak. Their constitutions are weak. They have no digestive fire. They have no passion for life. Digestive fire is the metaphysical relation to digesting life, wanting to absorb and assimilate the environment around them. Thriving through life creates a digestive fire. Yeah, most people have lost that. That's what I'm talking about, the systemic issue that comes from the powers that be. People feel constricted. They feel constrained. They're not flourishing. So their fire goes out. Now you try and put something like, you know, biophotons trapped in plant cells, living, driven by enzymes into your body that are full of moisture, highly structured water, into a body that's deficient, that's weak, that's, you know, not thriving, and that's going to dampen the spleen. And that's going to create sinking chi. And when that happens, then dampness sets into the body, cold sets into the body, all these deficiencies arise from the other organ systems, and we have a lot of issues from there. So, the Ayurvedic system and the Chinese system does also say that, particularly in Ayurveda, that a balanced human is tridoshic and is midway between prana and apana. Is not pranic, is not apanic, you're in the middle. You can do good back bends and you can do good forward bends. Yeah. Not one is better than the other. If one is better than the other, you're out of balance. If you're vata, you use the other two doshas to bring you back into balance. You don't use the other two doshas to keep you vata. You don't stay imbalanced. So there's systems to bring us back to a tridoshic state. We get our digestive fire back. We start to assimilate and process life, and we start frothing on life and creating and articulating life at the highest level. If you've ever, if any of your artists listening or people who paint or surf or do these things that require a lot of time, I mean, I paint. I will sit down and I'll be painting and I'll think, geez, I've got to go to the toilet, but I'll just finish this corner. And 2 hours go past and I'm like, geez, I've got to go to the toilet. I haven't eaten for a while. I'll make, you know, something, when I'll get that out of the fridge. I'll get that hummus and I'll eat those flax crackers and hummus while I'm painting. Another 2 hours will go past. I'm not even aware. I'll feel my bladder start tickling. So I haven't gone to the bathroom for 4 hours. I haven't eaten. And then I'm like, all right, I'll just finish this like layer. And I will go 6 or 8 hours without eating, without going to the bathroom. You know, like being in the now, being in that flow state in a healthy body is all we need. Because it's energy, yeah? We are pulling through energy from the vacuum into the physical world. And it's energy. And it supplements the need for consumption. Because we're in positive electronic state. We are producing. Instead of consuming, we are producing. So there's no resistance when we're producing. When we're consuming, we have degradation. Our iron in our blood starts to rot us from the inside. Iron is, red blood is rusting. Yeah, you look at these pictures of Shiva, you know, they're blue. You go in and study Egyptian knowledge on fasting and from the Egyptian mystery schools, they talk of times when your listeners are going to love this. when you have been fasting for such a long time and you've left the eating phase of transmuting energy and you're into higher states through your practices, and there's no oxidization in the blood, in the cells. So the red blood becomes blue blood.
That's fascinating.
And then our skin becomes blue. Our bodies become blue. Instead of having red blood, we have blue blood because we're not oxidizing. We're not degenerating.
Wow, that's
And that's in the manuscripts. That's in, you know. So anyone who talks about, you know, Ayurvedic says don't eat raw food, they're telling you half the story. They've jumped on a little thing and they're on this little adventure. They like their little stories. But Ayurveda says you shouldn't eat raw food. And, you know, I'm like Vata and I can't eat raw foods. Well, look, eventually that person is going to snap out of that story that they're telling themselves and stop playing the victim and come back to reality and get leverage over the situation that they're in and make the changes. Manifest the reality that you want to create. You're not a victim of the body. Don't let the body dictate to you what you're going to do today. You get up and you wake up in the body and you say, right, let's go. Every day I wake up and my body's like, no, just sleep in 30 minutes. And I'm like, we're getting on the mat today, sucker. You're coming with me. And the body's got all these reasons why we shouldn't get on the mat. And I'm like, all right, just one sun salutation. Let's just do it. And we get to one sun salutation. The body's like, all right, yeah, sure. This is cool. All right, that was a good one. Let's try another one. You know, 3 hours later, I'm freaking dropping in, like, to the pranayama, just going, I told you. And, you know, this happens all the time, but we've got to will it. You know, I could lay in bed and go, oh, you know, I'm Vata. I've got, like, I shouldn't be up before the sun and all this crap. You know, like, no way, man. You get in that body, you drive that thing as hard as you can to get what you want out of life. You want to put cooked food in the body, life begets life. Death begets death.
That is a beautiful way to end this. I love that. Ben, where can people reach out to you if they want to further their education or can meet you or come do one of your raw food certifications?
TheSeedsOfLife.net. And a lot of the journey from our previous training that just finished, as you know, is on Seeds of Life Bali Instagram. Yeah,
that's awesome. I know a couple of listeners already reached out to me to say they're on their way to Bali.
Oh, cool.
In the next year. Guys, I urge you to come to the cafe. Don't forget to come all the way to the back to come check out the tonic bar where we're sitting right now.
Yes.
It's gnarly. And if you see Ben, give him a shout out, man. He's done amazing work. And I hope to see many of you foodies out there creating more special spaces for all of us. So thank you.
Pleasure, bro. Thank you.
Lots of gratitude.
Yeah, great. Right on.
Raw foods and veganism have quickly become the latest buzzword and the most popular health trends on Google. Why? What is it about our collective consciousness that has given rise to this movement right now? Well, it seems some of us are not thriving, or simply many of us are looking for the edge in life to be the grand creators of our greatest dreams. As we look into many ways of reaching our fullest potential, it makes sense that before we make huge investments and changes to our lives, we take a closer look at improving the things we're already doing every day. I know I eat every day, and if you do too, then maybe it's time for us to embrace the advancements in technology and look closer into what it means to eat. Guys, I'm sure this is exactly the message you got from Ben and my conversation. Ben has taken a massive leap forward in trying to educate and innovate and inspire everybody out there, whether they're in Bali or across the world, to turn their life around through eating raw, nutrient-dense foods. I loved sitting with this man. He was so full of knowledge, from tonics that uses traditional Chinese medicine herbs, all the way to holographic kinetics and how we can reverse old negative energies from our past lives. He is super, super interesting, and I hope you reach out to him on all his social media links. Otherwise, reach out to me and I'll put you in contact with him. Thank you for listening again, and I will see you next week for a beautiful, beautiful new show where we are refining the audio for your ears and refining the show notes, and I'm slowly growing the team. So if you see the quality increasing slightly, that's because the team is increasing slightly and it's not just a one-man show anymore.
Reach out to me if you've got any guests in Cape Town in the next 3 weeks that you would like me to interview. I'm in town. I would love to meet, greet, and hang out with awesome co-creators and like-minded beautiful souls. Until next week, peace and love.